Alain Berthaud, his thoughts over what works in growing cities have been shaped by 5 decades as an urban planner and experience in 40 cities around the world. He believes combining economic principles with planning practice leads to greatly improved productivity for cities and also improves the welfare of residents. In his writing, he links cities' productivity to the size of its labour markets, which in turn means affordable housing and good transport in order to support the workforce. Alain Berthaud is a former principal urban planner at the World Bank. He now works in urbanisation at New York University. He's in New Zealand as a guest of the New Zealand Initiative, the Infrastructure Commission and Victoria University, and is to deliver a seminar on making cities work. He's with me in the Wellington studio. Bonjour, lovely to have you with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Why should cities be thought of as large labour markets?
Well, because we like a lot, you know, we like cities for many other things than working, clearly. We like cities for, being able to jog around park, to meet friends in a cafe or in a good restaurant, to go to concert. All those things are possible only if the labour market works well. So the labour market could be considered a bit at the foundation of all the things we like about cities. As we know, in a building, if the foundation fail, the entire building collapse. And I think that if the labour market collapse because a lack of transport or a lack of housing affordability, which prevents the workforce to renew itself, then everything we like about city collapse. Because this is the labour market is financing, in fact, everything we like, the superstructure, which is the thing we like in cities.
Financing it and also providing the people at the heart of cities.
Right, yeah. The cities, by the way, are not made of building or infrastructure. Cities are made of the people who are there. That's why building a new city out of nowhere is nearly impossible. Not impossible, always impossible, but very difficult because there is nobody there. And what attracts people in a city is the quality of the people who are there.
It occurs to me as I'm talking to you that one of the great cities of the world is Paris, which I, from memory, was fairly well designed. I'd love you to just take a bit of a diversion on that at some point. But many of the great cities that we might visit in the world, if we're thinking in the West, we're thinking London, yeah. New York, Paris, yes. Rome, and their hearts are incredibly compact. You can walk around their historical origins on foot.
Yes, for one good reason is that those cities were fortified. You know, even the fortification of Paris were still intact until the First World War, you know, which is the last city in Europe which has fortification. So that creates, of course, a compactness. I would say artificial compactness. And that means also rather narrow street because many of the streets, you know, streets are very resilient. By the way, when you talk about Paris being a plan, I would make a difference between separating what is public from what is private, that means a street network and also gardens and things like that, from what modern urban planners consider as plan, that means having a zoning which decide in advance where the shops will be, where the industry will be, how tall the building will be, what is the minimum size of apartment. This was never done until the 20th century.
What has happened, though, in the 20th century is this explosion in population growth right around the world from 1 billion to, what are we now,
8 billion.
8 yeah. billion in an extraordinary short time in history. So tell me more about what happened in some of those cities we're discussing as they grew that supports your point about what cities should be around, what they should be growing around.
Most of them, in fact, have been growing into greenfield, expanding, because income at the country urbanized, income increased also enormously. And so the people could afford larger houses. And then, of course, what changed enormously in the beginning of the 20th century, even late 19th century, was having mechanized transport. Instead of relying only on walking and horses, suddenly, the first metro, I think, was 1895 or something like that, and then expanding. So you see, for instance, cities like, or if you take the perimeter of Manhattan or Paris, up to 1910, the population was increasing, both in Paris, in Paris, again, the historical Paris and not the municipality of Paris, and Manhattan. And then suddenly both of, at exactly the same time, the population decreased. Now, both in Paris and in Manhattan, there are about 1 million less people than there were in 1900. And this is due to income increasing. You know, where you had a family living and possibly even working in Manhattan in one room or two rooms, now you have one family, usually one or two or three people living in four or five rooms.
However, Manhattan is an example of how an urban environment can densify. I mean, it is extraordinary. It's, what is it, 32 miles by 7-8 miles, something, Manhattan Island itself. It has done two things. It has grown up, obviously. It has some of the biggest high-rises in the world, but it also has the transport systems. So, and from memory, a very high proportion of Manhattan's population, a significant proportion, does commute in and commute out each day. So let's get to the heart of what you're talking about, which is that the city, the urban environment, should be built around its labour market, where people need to be to work. How closely, ideally, should they be able to live to where they work? And if it's not walking distance, what does that mean for transport links?
The idea of a labour market is not that everybody has a job. The idea of a labour, what creates, let's say, stimulates the creativity of people and their productivity is the ability to select a job among many other jobs. And and the possibility of changing job. You know, in the Soviet Union, everybody was employed. The cities were relatively compact. You know, Moscow has also a pretty high density. But there was no labor market. That means when you get out of school or college, you were assigned a job and you could not change. So the productivity of free market economy is that during your career, as your skill change, as you learn certain things, you are able to change job where you optimize, either you optimize to have the largest possible salary or maybe optimize to have the most interesting job, and or a mix of both, probably. So there are trade-offs. So it means that the idea that you are likely in a large city like Paris or New York find a job within 15 minutes walk from your house is very, very little. I mean, it could happen, but you are extremely lucky if this is so. In fact, maybe you have a 15-minute walk to a job during 2 or 3 years, and suddenly you find another job which is much more attractive somewhere else. So this is why we have to consider the labor market should be unified. You know, the fragmentation of labor market, by the way, happened in large city. I have example in Mexico City, for instance, 20 million people, but they do not have the productivity of a labor force that would be about 12 million people. They do not have this productivity because the transport system is so bad that, in fact, most people who live in the suburb can get a job only in their own suburb, you know, within 1 hour. I consider that about 1 hour transport time one way is absolute maximum. The ideal would be more around 30 minutes.
So what are the implications of this for how cities grow and who decides? You've got your influential book, 2018 book, Order Without Design, How Markets Shape Cities, incidentally, which has been cited by politicians on both sides of the political divide here as carrying wisdoms. But what are the consequences of what you're saying when it comes to urban planning? Who does what?
I think that the government, the state, either local government or provincial or national government, their main job is to separate in advance what is private from what is public. For instance, in particular here, maybe in New Zealand, where you have natural features which are rather extraordinary, mountain beaches, the sea penetrating within the land. I mean, it's absolutely unique. There are a lot of public good there, what I call public good, which have to be protected. The market will not protect that, a mountain or access to beaches, for instance, the shore, which I think is very important for everybody. If you privatize the shore, a lot of people will be preventing from each other. So this separation is very important. So it's mostly a surveyor job. It's not a planner job, to separate what is public, what is private. Within what is public, the government has to not necessarily, it could be private, but the government has to intervene to make sure that there is a transport system which allow anybody in a city to move from one side of the city to the other.
Is this local government or central government, or both?
Well, depending on your constitution, usually transport will be a local government thing, but probably with transfer from the national, terms of financing. So again, that depends on your constitution, really.
Yeah. But the government has responsibility, for sufficient transport links.
Right, yeah. So again, the transport could be private, but the government has to regulate it, in order to, for instance, because this transport system is going to use private, public right-of-way. So, the government has...
Who's going to fund it? That's another question.
Well, normally you pay for transport. We pay for transport. Experience shows that, with the exception of Hong Kong, was, I think, I don't know if it's still the truth, but say 20 years ago, Hong Kong entirely capital finance and operation was entirely funded by the profits of the transport company, which included real estate, by the way. They around their station and above their station, they were using air ride to build. So in a way, it was a mixed company, both real estate and transport at the same time, which was very efficient.
Let's stay with transport, because this is a key issue between building more roads.
Yes.
Out to sprawling suburbs.
Right,
and then perhaps a significant one-off investment in something we don't have here, which is the subway systems of larger cities.
Yes.
So when we talk transport links, again, who determines what they are? What is efficient? What is not?
Transport also is not only to transport people, but it's also, it defines the area which is buildable. And so it's very much linked to affordability, housing affordability, because to have affordable housing, you need to have a sufficient amount of land. And land is usable in a big city only if you have infrastructure. So you don't need only transport. You need water. You need the storm drainage. You need sewer. You need, of course, social facilities, schools, things like that. So the supply of land is absolutely essential. Now, agricultural land needs to be transformed into urban land through infrastructure. An infrastructure which is largely sufficient to support, an agricultural population is not at all the same as one for an urban population. And that, again, the government has to intervene there in order to provide this infrastructure. So it controls, it's not only transport, it controls the supply of land. So if you're...
And here's where we get into an interesting argument in New Zealand, which is free up the greenfields land, free up the land that currently or has been used as high-quality land for agriculture, horticulture in many instances. Then you get into the argument of who's going to provide the transport links, who's going to provide the infrastructure links, and who pays. Like, can you hone in on what has been an issue for our country, which is a sprawl outwards and perhaps develop his own market incentives to land bank or to buy more land more cheaply and then release it, a sprawl outwards versus encouraging or incentivising a focus around those already built centres. Like, what is your core thesis on how that should work and how which should be incentivised or disincentivised?
I don't like so much the word sprawl because it has a, in English, I think, a negative implication. I will use the word extension. In New Zealand, you have a country which has about the size of the UK in area, and you have a population a little more, about 5 million. So you have plenty of land.
Got a few mountains in the way in a few parts.
Yes.
But anyway, but yes.
Yeah.
But what's efficient? Like, if you come back to your core thesis, so here, what's efficient?
It's a trade-off. Mm-hmm. Both, let's say, a city is made of households and firms. Those households have different income, by the way. There's always a huge difference between the poorest household in a city and the richest one. It's an interesting curve, actually, mathematically. And all of those households are making personal trade-off between consuming more land or less land, more floor space or less floor space, and location. This trade-off is personal to every household. No urban planner can guess what it is, and using an average is terrible. You know, an average, you know, trade-offs are personal. So that's why you have families who are ready to commute 1 hour but live rather far away of the city and, you know, in more land, maybe beautiful view or something like that, and other who are ready to live in pretty small apartment close to the center. The planner should allow those trade-offs. For firms, it's the same thing. You know, depending on what you do, you need something absolutely downtown, or you could have
where the land is more expensive, right?
More expensive, rent will be more expensive.
Yeah.
You know, you may have also problem of access if you need to, to bring trucks in to, you know, to feed your business. So every firm is making also a trade-off between being in the centre or going in the suburb.
We've had city developers in Auckland talking to us that the freeing up of land, greenfields land,
yes,
further out, the economics works against them. It is cheaper, it is more cost-effective for the developer to keep moving out. So if we come back to the ideal, which is that people want more affordable housing, say in our biggest city, in Auckland, say, and other cities are growing very fast as well, Canterbury, Christchurch, Hamilton being examples. What's the economics you're talking about there? What is it that either inhibits or encourages the ability to build more affordable homes there?
So there are two aspects. Again, it's the amount of land you need to build 1 square meter of floor space.
Well, land or air? If you're going up, it's air.
That's exactly my point.
Uh-huh.
That the amount of land is very different. You know, you could have skyscraper in the center using very little land, or you could have villas where, let's say, for 1 square meter of floor space, you need 3 square meter of land. But if you are in the center, you could have, you know, 1 square meter of floor space using, a quarter of a square meter of land. So this, again, it's not a fantasy of an architect saying, I like to build a skyscraper. It's just what economists will call substituting capital for land. You know, if land is expensive, you tend to use much less. But then, by the way, building high costs more than per square meter of construction. So
if you look at our issue, I'm sure you're familiar with it in our biggest city in Auckland. I mean, there's so many twists and turns, I don't expect you to keep up.
Yeah.
But right now, the arguments that intensification plans, actually that central government is by a roundabout mechanism requiring of local government there, to build up intensity to allow higher buildings around what has been a publicly funded transport system,
yes,
is now being sort of pushed back on again. Like, come back to your core point about who should be deciding what around what can happen in cities.
The government, you know, I think there have been a confusion in the debate. I listened the other day to the speech of the Honourable Chris Bishop, and I saw, I think there is a bit of confusion between the government allowing to build higher and the government obliging people to build higher. When the government oblige, let's say, community in the urban area, oblige them to allow people to build higher if they want.
Yeah,
it's not a central plan like the Soviet Union saying this
no,
is
no,
what.
No, no, no. But this is our complication. Yeah, this is the government requiring the council to allow it.
Yes.
Because politics intervening.
Frankly, in the long run, I think that it is it's in a national survival issue. You know, without cities which are affordable and viable, the economy of New Zealand will turn around. I think so. I mean, I may be wrong. I may
take your credit. So in this instance we're facing, you've got central government wanting the ability for densification to happen.
Yes.
You've got central government which has ministers with electorates that may be impacted by this.
Right, yeah.
You've got a local council saying, we think these are the areas where the greatest productivity gain, the greatest ability for people to be able to live more affordably near where they are working, near transport links, yeah, we think this is the logical plan. And then you've got the two of them going head to head over this. What would you say should happen?
It's a little, I see it a different angle. A city can provide more floor space two ways. One is densifying the existing area. That means when you have already 5-story allowing 10-story, for instance, or when you have 2 or 3-story. So that's densification of existing. That means within a lot, you have already a house with 2 floors and you allow 4 floors. Or on the same lot, you allow in the backyard an additional building, maybe smaller. So that's densification of existing area. Then the other way is to expand in agriculture, you know, non-urban area, agricultural area or whatever, and to have greenfield development. The two are absolutely necessary at the same time. Why? Because the densification of existing area is very efficient because you use existing infrastructure. However, it's relatively slow. It depends on the initiative of existing, you know, homeowner or existing owner of land. And that's relatively slow. They need to have a big incentive. They need, in a way, to have maybe the price of house even going higher to justify demolishing what is existing and replacing it. However, in greenfield development, you can have a large supply of housing relatively fast because there is nothing there. And therefore, you could even build, for instance, townhouses if there is a demand for it. And by the way, looking at some statistics, I see that there is a hidden demand for townhouses. You know, as soon as you relax some land use regulation, you see the building of townhouses shooting up, which means that this was a constrained demand, which was constrained by artificial regulation. So we have to have these two sides at the same time. You know, to say densification is the only way, I think is a mistake. Mm. And to say greenfield is the only way is also a mistake. You have to have two at the same time.
What of... So when it comes back to what the urban planners, the council boffins essentially, should be doing or should not be doing, and remember we've got central government intervening in that right now, how far do you go in saying hands off? Like, what should the model look like as far as you're concerned?
Well, the model should be demand-driven, not supply-driven. That means it's not, nobody should design a city and say the density should be there. They should allow demand to be satisfied and not constrained by regulation, which very often were put there 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. Mm. For instance, you know, our regulation, all land use regulation over the world, are always obliging people to use more land and more floor space than they will want. That's, you know, you have a minimum lot size, minimum apartment size, maximum height of building, or maximum floor ratio. These are all the regulations are saying, if you were left to your own device without regulation, you will consume less land, and you force them to consume. So those are, you know...
Regulators have a role, though, in considering other factors, like the developer might be drawn by the particular price attractiveness of a greenfields development, but again, who is going to supply the infrastructure? Who is going to supply the roading potentially needed? Which tends to come from if it's getting outside of local roads, then we could be getting up to state highways, for example. Do planners have a role in looking at the spillover effects of what the developer, the provider of the supply, finds optimal?
Yes, but planners have to work very closely with economists who look at the fiscal effect of you know, of development, and that's a big part of my book. Is that you know, expanding cities is not just about design; it's about the cost to the taxpayer. And, you know, at the end, it's always, you know, we say the government, it's a taxpayer who's going to pay. And who is going to pay what and when? And I think that's one of the major mistakes that I found a bit everywhere with few exceptions, regional exception, is that we do not have a very clear system to finance extension of infrastructure. There is either a tendency to that the infrastructure is free for the developers, so it's kind of a you know, it's a disconnection between the real cost and the price of a property, or to do the opposite, to charge the developer with to pay right away the cost of an infrastructure which life will be probably over 30 years. So there should be a system for financing infrastructure so that extension is paid by the people who use it, but still have a financial system. So exactly like when you have a mortgage, you pay for your property over 30 years rather than right away. Because if not, then you constrain development and artificially. So again, that's the essence of it, is more economic being taken into account in development and not less. And for the moment, most cities in the world, even sophisticated cities like New York or London, do not take this economics in account.
Do we have a particular challenge because in many ways we are comparatively very small population? Are there economies of scale in having rapid population growth and rapid development accompanying it? And are we caught a bit betwixt and between?
Yes, but on the other hand, if you look at your economy, services are becoming more important, including by probably exporting services, you know, in the future. When you have a high tech company coming here in New Zealand, and probably in the future it will be more and more feasible because precisely the quality of your environment, by the way, which I mean, for a foreigner is extraordinary. So you have an interest of having growing cities, because only growing cities can recruit enough people who have a very narrow specialty but have to work together. I learned that even when I was working at the World Bank, to have, as an architect, my background is architecture, as an architect, to be able to work with a municipal engineer, somebody who knew exactly the price of road and the price of maintaining roads, was very important for me. Understanding people who knew about the fiscality of a city, you know, how a city can finance that. So these are very narrow specialty. and you get better in your specialty, but to the condition that you can work with somebody who knows something else. I mean, and that is in large cities.
You just anticipated another question, which is work from home and our migration to online commerce.
Yes.
Do you see that radically changing the economics you wrote your book about? Or will, as you've just pointed out, will there always be a base desire to physically be in touch to some degree?
Yes, I think if you look at what the high-tech company have been doing, in particular in Silicon Valley, the people of Silicon Valley are the most able to work at any distance, including New Zealand working in New York or in Silicon Valley, if possible. However, all those big companies have built enormous headquarters with a lot of facilities. You know, you have cafeteria where you have 20 type of food available. You have a kindergarten to encourage women to come to the office with their children. So they want people to be face-to-face because the productivity comes from random meetings between people, not by organized meetings.
One final point on San Francisco. It has become impossibly, impossibly expensive for the very labor market we've been talking about, other than that particular high-tech specialty, to live in that city anymore. The affordability's gone. So what went wrong?
Very rigid land use regulation, which were imposed long ago and which prevent densification and extension of the city. You know, it takes 10, sometimes 15 years to approve a building permit for a building of, 20 apartments.
It's a beautiful city, though, isn't it?
It is a beautiful city. But you see, those restrictions come with beautiful.
Yeah.
If a city is beautiful, people don't want it to change, and therefore they will not allow any change in land use. But they will not survive if there is no change.
A pleasure talking to you. Thank you for making time. That is Alain Berthaud, who is here as a guest of the New Zealand Initiative Infrastructure Commission, Victoria University. He's delivering a seminar on making cities work and is author also of Order Without Design, a 2018 book, which, as I said, has influenced many of our politicians on both sides of the fence.